So the five steps of engaging are, number one, you must prepare. You must prepare. That is, you've got to do your homework so that when you go there to communicate with someone, you're ready. You're ready to make the sale. You know who you're dealing with. You know what your product's about. And we're going to tell you six keys to preparing so that when you go in there, you're really, really ready. Number two, you got to turn on, which is turning on your state. Turning on your emotion, turning on your physiology, turning on your passion, really putting yourself in a peak state. Three is you got to make contact. If you're well prepared and you're all pumped up, but you don't talk to anybody, you got a problem. And that's how a lot of salespeople are, aren't they? They get all pumped up and they don't do anything. So make sure you got to make contact. And we're going to talk about not only how to make contact, but you might want to add something to that. Make contact and get their attention. That's actually the full step, is make contact and get their attention. If you don't have their attention, nothing else is going to matter. Step four is connect and become their best friend. You want to create rapport. And then finally, step five is create strong interest. Create interest. Create interest. Because again, all we're doing in phase one is we want them engaged. We want to be engaged, and we want to be engaging and have them be engaged with us. So we got to know something about what we're going to do and be prepared. We got to be turned on. We got to make contact, connect with a person, and get their interest before we ever try and present something to them. Does that make sense to you? So we've got the first five steps. We're halfway home. Let's go to phase two. Phase two is called enrolling. There are two steps to the phase two. To enroll somebody, you've got to probe for problems and magnify the hurt. Doesn't that sound wonderful? Sounds horrible, but it's what we got to do. Some people call this qualifying. And we could have called it qualifying for short. If that helps you, you can do that. But I would say probe for problems and magnify the hurt. Because what we're doing when we're qualifying, yes, we're going to find out, do they have the authority to buy? We're going to find out, do they have the money to buy? Do they have the desire to buy? But what we're really looking for is, what are their deepest needs that we can help match or meet? And what are those needs that are not being met that they have some pain about so we can help motivate them? And really get them to take the actions that create a better quality of life. Much like the businessman I talked about earlier, we've got to find what that person's needs are. Even if they don't think they're there, you can usually find them. Not always, but usually there really is a need. So step six, we want to probe for problems and magnify the hurt. And again, some people think, God, magnifying the hurt, that sounds like you're doing something terrible. Wrong. If you want to motivate anyone, you've got to get them to focus on and see something in a way that motivates them. Anybody who's ever been motivated to do something has usually got something pushing them. They may not want to admit that. They say, no, it's all for these other reasons. But usually there's something there. Again, our country is here because we had enough hurt to make a change. There's a lot of ways to look at this. Make sure that you have positive feelings about this. And if you don't, then all you're going to do is limit the number of people you can effectively motivate. So probe for problems, magnify the hurt. Step seven, create conviction and test close. Now, creating conviction for me might be like building, or the selling process could be perceived as this leverage where what we're trying to do is get lots of urban emotional reasons to buy now, some lurban logical reasons to buy now, and we're trying to get enough of that so that what happens is we kick somebody over the edge, so that whatever the objections are get catapulted out of there. So creating conviction and test closing. What we're going to do with a test close is we're going to take a look and see, are they ready to buy yet? If they're not, we're going to probably do more. Add more what? Conviction. Now, last phase and the last three steps. Phase number three is compel. Step number eight is we want to make it real and assume the sale. Step number nine, convert objections into commitments. And finally, step number 10, make it easy. So these are our 10 steps. Forget about the phases. They're just designed so that while you're selling, you can say, okay, have I really got them fully engaged? If I'm engaged, it's because I was prepared. Absolutely, I was in a situation, I was turned on, I was in my best state. I'm in a situation here where I've done what? I've made what? Contact. I feel and they feel what? Connected. And I've got their what?
Interest.
So now I say, okay, then I need to start enrolling them. How do I do enroll that? Well, the first thing I do is what? Probe for problems and magnify the hurt. And then once I've done that, what do I do? Create some what? In other words, I'm giving my presentation, giving them reasons to buy, now that I know what reasons they want, and I'm, as soon as I'm doing that, I'm test, so I'm seeing, hey, are they ready to buy yet? They may be ready right now. Finally, if they're now enrolled, what I got to do now? Just get them to feel what? Compelled. How do I do that? I make the presentation real so they really know they're going to get what they want, and if they have any what? Objections. I convert objections into commitments. And lastly, I just make it what?
Easy
to buy. So those are the steps. So what we're going to do now is we're going to take each one of them piece by piece and show you exactly how to make those real for you as well. Step number one, preparation. It's the thing that the average salesperson does very little of, and a master persuader consistently does before he meets the client or the prospect. In fact, the reason I call them a client is master persuaders usually think of them as a client, not just a prospect. They know enough about this person that they believe that they're going to be their client shortly. Shortly meaning as soon as they meet them. Now, what do I mean by preparation? I mean do your homework. Now, most salespeople don't even think in terms of homework. But I want to give you what I consider to be six very key and important things you want to do so that you're better prepared. And let me tell you why you want to prepare, because I know that sounds so simple. Be prepared. I remember that. But it's probably as important as anything else you're going to do. The lack of preparation is what I think creates call reluctance. Meaning, why don't you call on people? Why is it such a heavy-duty thing? I would say it's because you don't know who it is you're calling on. Or you know who you're calling on, but you're a little concerned about whether or not you can handle the objections and the problems. You're not ready. And so what a lot of people do is they just, you know, go at it half-heartedly anyway, or they don't make the call in the first place. I'm saying let's go for a balanced, strong approach. And here are six very simple steps to preparation. Step number one, absolutely know who the customer is and anticipate some of the needs or hurts they will have. In other words, what you want to do is find out as much as you possibly can before you walk in that door about those wants. Find out as much as you can about their values, about how they spend their time, their energy, their money. Now, how can you go about doing this? Well, a good friend of mine, Harvey McKay, phenomenal man and a brilliant salesman. And one of the things that Harvey taught me is he taught me what he calls his McKay 66, which are just 66 questions that he demands all of his salespeople be able to answer about any customer they're going to call on. Harvey's been extremely successful in the printing business all over the country. And the reason is he really knows who he's dealing with. He knows everything from their birthdays and their children's names to where they went to school to what are some of their favorite colors. I mean, the amount of information that his people get is rather astounding. Now you might say, well, Tony, I'm not in that kind of business. I'm not in a sales business where I go sell something one time and I have their business forever. I can't spend that much time. Well, maybe you won't do the McKay 66, but maybe you can do the Robbins half dozen. Maybe what you can do is come up with a few key ideas that you can find out that are useful. And I need you, obviously, to adapt this to the kind of selling you do. If you're doing corporate sales, you might have, for example, a long sales cycle where you sell over a period of weeks or months. Or you might be one of those people that's right there on the spot. You meet somebody, you have to grab their interest and close the sale. You still have to be prepared for that person also. So here are the ways. Again, number one, find out who they are. Now you say, but Tony, if I'm in direct sales, I don't know anything about them and there's no way to find out. Oh, yes, there is. Even if you're selling door to door, there is. What if when you knock on the person's door and let's say that person rejects you, you say, well, let me ask you a question. Could you help me? Could you tell me a little bit about your neighbor here, Mr. Jones? Is that his name? No, it's not Mr. Jones. What's your neighbor's name? And they tell you all about the neighbor saying, well, do you think this person could have any benefit from this? Why? Now, first of all, they're happy that you've left them off the hook in the first place. Second of all, they may very well be able to tell you, you know, I really doesn't meet my needs, but I think Mr. Jones would, and here's why. Now you walk in, you say, Mr. Jones, guess what? I just met Mr. Williams here, your neighbor. And he tells me all about your needs, about this and this and this. Well, how'd you know that? All of a sudden, you've got more rapport and you're better prepared. Does that make sense? Now, if you've got someone that you're calling on and you know who they are in advance, now's the time to prepare, and there's lots of sources you can go to. First source, of course, is always a referral. Always you want to be working as strongly as possible from somebody else. And what you want to find out is, what do you like about this person? Find out what they like about them, because what that'll do is it'll prepare you emotionally to like the person, and you'll go into the situation expecting this person to treat you well. You'll know something great about them, and you'll be able to share the compliment later on. You'll be able to say, you know, I talked to Mr. Jones, and he told me how blank you are, and now you've done several things. You've built rapport, you've given the person a compliment, and you've given them a reputation to live up to, all just because you prepared a little bit, found out a little bit more about them. In addition, you don't want to just find out about what people like about them, but ask them, what do you think about our product really benefit them? And begin to find out a little bit about the benefits that could be achieved by their using your product. So the more you can know about that prospect or customer before you meet them, the more powerful you're going to be. And it'll get rid of all this call reluctance stuff that you have, which is, you know, I don't want to call them because you don't know anything. Get to where you know it. Harvey McKay talks about in corporate selling, one of the things that he does is he checks all kinds of sources. He doesn't just go for a friend. He'll go to the newspaper morgue, and he has a friend there, and he'll call that person up. You make a friend. Somebody you can call over there, you can pay them, or they'll usually do it at no charge, and say, listen, can you run me off all the material on this particular person? And all of a sudden, you can find out by reading a couple articles that, hey, this gentleman is really an avid golfer, or this person just closed this particular kind of deal, and what it'll help you to do is find some problems this person may have, as well as some interests they have that you can help to support in making things work. Another thing he does is he talks to stockbrokers, bankers. Many times he'll go to everything from, you know, annual stock reports. He'll buy sometimes one stock in a company he's going to sell to so that he gets all the information about that company and some of the key people he's going to market to. So there are a lot of areas to look, but number one key to preparation is know who you're selling to and anticipate possible needs, desires, wants, and problems they may have, and how you can help fulfill those before you even walk in the door. One caveat. Make sure you're not so certain about the person and their needs that when you walk in the door, you don't stop to find out their needs currently as you meet them. Here's key number two to preparation. Make sure you absolutely thoroughly know your own product and the advantages and benefits it has. As many advantages and benefits as you can possibly put together. And later on, we're going to have you actually create lists of advantages and benefits so you're knowing what they are and can run them off. And I don't just mean the ones you normally think of. I want you to dig a little deeper. I want you to have such a list of advantages and benefits that you have strong feelings about that you can overwhelm the prospect with advantages and benefits once you know what their specific needs are. So you've got to obviously know your own product. Number three, know your competition. Make sure you know your competition. That's part of preparation. That is, be clear about what the competition is and what are the advantages you have over the competition. That's real important. You know, some people say, well, I don't want to know what they're doing. Yes, you do. You want to know exactly what they're doing. You want to know all their advantages. And never knock the competition. Never knock them in front of the client. You can knock them within your own mind. That's fine. You wouldn't be selling your product unless you felt it was better. But don't knock them in front of anybody else. It lacks class and status. We've all been guilty of it at times. But pay attention. You don't need to do that. It's not going to make you any better. It'll probably make you look worse in the eyes of the customer or the client. But make sure you know who they are and what your advantages are over them so you can be very elegant about it, so they have a lot of great things. Here are some things that I think we supply that no one else I know of supplies. Make sense? Fourth key to being extremely well prepared. You've got to know all the potential objections that come up for your product and have answers ready in advance. Here's another reason why a lot of salespeople do not follow through and don't really go for it. I mean, why wouldn't you cold call if you knew who the person was or had a general idea of their interests and you knew your product cold and you knew it was worth tons more than what you were going to ask for in return, you believed in it 100%, and you were in a position where any objection they could give you, you were thoroughly prepared to turn around. In fact, you looked forward to it because it was fun. It gave you a chance to be creative. Wouldn't that be a lot different than how it maybe has been in the past? And I'll tell you a few of them that are obvious that people have to be able to handle. Think it over. That's a critical one. And I don't mean just the traditional way you've learned to do that. We'll talk about some traditional ones when we get to the closing step of the 10 steps to sales mastery. There'll also be some other ways to handle it that are much simpler, but do you know how to close that? Do you know how to close it at such a level of certainty that, hey, when somebody gives you that objection, there is no fear in you, there is no concern. In fact, it's exciting because you go, oh, great, I know how to deal with that. After you know how to think it over, you got to take things like no need. And in fact, I've already shown you one way to deal with no need. Agree with a customer. Do you remember that? They say, I don't have a need. Agree with them. Boy, you've got a lucky person here working with you. They're lucky to have you as a client. And I think they must be doing a good job. Do you mind if I ask you a question? What are three things that they're doing that really are great for you? They get all excited. What are three things that need to be improved? Boom. So one way to handle no need is show them there is one, right? But do it elegantly, not the traditional way we've all been trained in. Another one to handle, of course, is not just think it over and no need, but you got to have cost too much. You got to be able to deal with them saying things like, well, the competition's product is less expensive, or I've been dealing with brand X forever. So you got to have enough ways. Somebody says, I have no money. You got to be able to handle that objection. So what you need to do is brainstorm out every possible objection you can possibly imagine that a person could have and have down cold a half dozen ways to handle it so that when somebody does it, there is not one ounce of fear. And by the way, most salespeople are so afraid of the no's. And yet, if you look and interview the best salespeople in the world, Marty Shofaroff says this, that until you've gotten at least five no's, the selling process has not even begun. If you're hanging up on the second or third no, you're wasting your time. People got to at least say five no's before they're serious about it. And he says, besides that, the more no's they get, the kinder they usually get if you're kind with them. Interesting. See, somebody said something in this course that I thought was really valuable. One of the participants came up to me during one of these breaks and said, listen, he said, you know that stuff you taught about reciprocation? And I said, yeah. He said, you know what? Reciprocation, when somebody gives you an objection, he said, that starts the process. When they reject you, it starts the process of reciprocation. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, think about it. If your kids come to you and ask you for something, and you say no, and they come back the next day and they ask you for something, you say no, and they come back a third day and you say no, pretty soon, don't you start feeling like, I hate that to keep saying no to these kids. Don't you usually kind of like try and give them something back at some point? Has that been your experience, yes or no? In my experience, it usually is. So I believe that with customers as well, that there is a similar process. It's a great way of explaining it, but I've noticed that if you keep working with somebody and you're still really nice, they tend to get nicer as you get beyond the fifth or sixth no, and pretty soon they don't want to object anymore. And if you get enough hurt and enough logical reasons to support you, many times you can kick them right over the edge. But again, you've absolutely got to know every objection that could possibly come up, have answers ready, and be effective in their delivery. What do I mean by effective with their delivery? I mean they can't just be rote. You got to believe what you're talking about. And they can't just be words. You have to have a voice and body communication process that's consistent. But when you say something, your voice, your body, and your tonality all match. Fifth key to being extremely well prepared. Not only do you got to be prepared in terms of knowing your prospect and yourself and handle the objections, you've got to be able to be willing to expect the best but prepare for the worst. And the reason I say that is that in life, a lot of people say, well, you know, you got to expect the best and that's what life's all about. I agree, but I believe in a balance. And there were a lot of times I was expecting the best and the worst happened. And so I suggest to you that what you really need to do is expect the best, because your state is everything. Your expectation walking in makes a big difference in how you communicate to someone. But I think you also should prepare for the worst in that you should be prepared for them not to support you and know how to deal with it so it's not a surprise and you're not upset. Where this really works for me most is, I would say, A, put yourself in a state before you get to that person, part of your preparation, where you expect to really meet their needs and you expect them to treat you well. Because people many times will live up to the expectations you give them in your own mind and in the way you communicate. But also I say, B, part of expectation is having a really good plan, like a good plan for your day as an example. Well, you expect it to go perfect. But if I were you, I would also plan for the worst. I'd plan for people to cancel appointments. Now, when I say plan for it, I mean have an alternative ready. I don't think that's being negative. I think that's being intelligent. Because too many people, they expect their day to be a certain way, then somebody cancels, and is that invariably going to happen in your sales career, yes or no? Yes. You better believe it. So instead of getting all upset about it, see, in life, if something happens, and you know it's going to happen more than once, and every time it happens you get upset, then you're always going to be at the effect of things. Instead, say, there's going to be a percentage of people that are going to do this. I don't like it, but it's what's true. So let me have a better plan. And the plan is, maybe you've got a list of calls to make, so when that inevitable appointment cancels, you can pop on the phone and your time is well used. You're expecting the best, but you're prepared if the worst happens. That's the process, I think, of preparation. Step six, make sure that you create demand. Let me clarify what I mean by that. Hopefully, you're beginning to pick up that this course is not just about learning how to sell. That this course is about teaching you how to be a persuader, someone who can really influence. And if you think of yourself as even more than just selling, you're thinking of yourself in terms of influence, you need to start thinking about being a marketer. And the distinction is, a marketer is the kind of person who looks at how to create a demand before they even get there. That's what marketing is. I mean, think about it. It's not just going out and persuading somebody. It's before you even get there, hopefully having them already have a want for your product. I'll give you a classic example. Again, Harvey McKay, because he's got some really great examples. Harvey has this example he talks about where he says, in studying marketing, that he's from Minneapolis, and he helped build the big dome there. And when they built the dome, they destroyed the old stadium they had. And so there's this prime land available in Minneapolis, and no one was building anything. And if they build something there, obviously there's tax revenues and all these jobs. And so when all of a sudden General Motors was coming out with this new plant that they had, sure enough, people in Minneapolis were fighting all the other cities in the country to try and get that. I think it was the Saturn plant. And they did not win. So they were pretty disappointed. Along come these four brothers from Canada, the Gremesian brothers. And the Gremesian brothers, if you're not familiar with them, are the people that built the biggest mall in the world. They call it the Eighth Wonder of the World. It has like this fantasy hotel built into it. I forget, like $50 million hotel or something like that. It's hundreds and hundreds of shops. It has this huge set of lakes inside of it and an amusement park all in a mall. It's in Edmonton, Canada. Phenomenal, phenomenal place. And they funded the whole thing. Well, they come along and see this thing, and they come to Minneapolis, and they approach the governor of the state of Minnesota, and they say, look, we'll come in, we want to build this mall, we'll do all these things, we'll pay you top dollar, we'll do the whole thing. $1.5 billion is what we're going to be generating, a project of that size that'll create 40,000 new jobs, right, at, you know, union scales. Would you like to do it? What do you think the governor said? Well, of course. I mean, that's incredible. And he got all this excitement. But they made a major mistake. They didn't prepare for a standard human emotion. And that human emotion is, if things appear to be too good to be true, people, most people think, then they are. In fact, you and I have been conditioned that. If it's too good to be true, it probably is. Isn't that true? Well, their deal, by not making people have to work for it, by not creating any demand, what happened is the governor got all excited, and all of a sudden he realized he was out on this limb, and he began to think, well, God, this seems too good to be true. There must be a catch. Now, he could never find one, but that scared him even more. Because he said, there must be a catch here, and I don't know what it is. I mean, why are they giving us everything we want? Why aren't they demanding? Why aren't they fighting us for this thing? And by the way, the answer is because they're so successful, they figured, hey, even if we give them top dollar, we'll still be successful. So they didn't make them work. And the governor started to get concerned. Well, what if I put myself on the limb, get behind this thing, and it falls apart? Then I would look like a jerk. That could be political suicide. You know, what if people get upset? And sure enough, they almost lost the deal. And the reason is because they didn't think like an intelligent marketer. They didn't prepare. Preparation would have looked like this. What they could have done is they could have created a demand like General Motors did. They could have said, look, we may come here, we may not come here. We're looking for the best spot and for the best possible deal. Then they would have had people fighting like GM did. So you got to realize value, the value of anything, is all based on perception. And a lot of perception comes from demand, doesn't it? I mean, think about it. What is the price of gold? Goes up and down depending on demand. The price of stock goes up and down based on demand. And demand is just how much perception. If you want to be good, you need to create yourself as being in demand. Years ago, I did that when I started doing therapies. I charged more than anybody else, and I made it harder to get to see me, and it was unbelievable. I did that because I wanted some time. I ended up having more clients than I could possibly see. So think in terms of preparation, and the preparation in this case could have been, you know, exposing some of the unions or exposing in the newspapers that the Gremesian brothers are looking for a place to take a mall. And this is one place they were considering, but they didn't know if there was enough community support. And sure enough, watch what happens. They send 40,000 jobs. The union people come out and say, we want those jobs. People in the community say, we want that thing. And if they had a fight for it, they would value it more. Remember commitment and consistency? Make sure you create a demand. And you say, Tony, well, I can't do this. Well, the first five steps you can absolutely do. Step six, you may not always be able to do, but I want you to think about it. Is there a way you can create a demand? One way to do that might be to go in and do a poll for a company. So that's how we create demand from the bottom up. We don't always just go to the person who's the CEO. We go to the people around the CEO and expose them. So all of a sudden, there's all these people saying, we want this program. Rather than go to the CEO, he may say, well, you know, Tony, your program's great, but, you know, I don't want to shove it down the throats of my people. Ha, we're better prepared. Be creative. So what are the six steps? Make sure, number one, you know who you're dealing with. Make sure you know what some of their needs and wants are, if you can, up front. Number two, really know your product and anticipate all the advantages that you could give that person. Number three, know your competition. Know your competition. Four, make sure that you know all the objections that can come up and have answers. Five, make absolutely certain that you're in a situation where you expect the best, plan for the worst. And six, make sure that if there's any way possible, you create some demand in advance. And one way to do that in a simple way would be have the person who gave you the referral call them and tell them all the great things about it. Already you're starting to create some demand. So that's called step number one, preparation.